guys, and welcome to episode 184 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview Dr. Amy Mariaskin, and in this episode, we specifically address the OCD theme of gender identity, or sometimes called transgender OCD. Amy has experience working with both the transgender population, and she's an OCD therapist, so she works with people with OCD. So she could come at this with a unique and interesting perspective. So I hope if this is something that affects you, I hope you find it useful. And as always, OCD is OCD. So the stuff Amy shares and talks about, I'm sure you can relate to it with your own themes that are bothering you at this time. But first, we talk about her kind of anxiety story and her therapy story. I ask her, you know, what's the story behind her clinic's logo, which is a staircase. That's an interesting one. And then first off, she explains the terms that she's going to be using around gender fluid, non-binary, etc. Then I ask her, what are some of the obsessions and compulsions around this theme? What some of the example exposures look like for this theme? She offers her words of hope, self-compassion, and much, much more. Hopefully you've done this topic and this theme well, and hopefully you find it useful. And thank you as always for following the podcast. I deeply appreciate it. And thank you to Amy. So without further ado, here she is.
On the podcast today, I'm joined by Dr. Amy Mariaskin. Amy is a licensed clinical psychologist and director at the Nashville OCD and Anxiety Treatment Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you on. So as you know, I always get people's either their OCD story or their, in this case, therapy story. So it'd be good to little as much detail as you want.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I definitely thought about how I was going to answer this question, because I think there are a few different ways that I could. But if I'm being 100% honest kind of about why I do what I do, I would say that my story kind of starts in the mid-80s, 1980s. I'm on the school bus coming home from Colfax Elementary School in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And two seats behind me is Lenny P., who, as a kid, gets off at my bus stop. But before we get there, he stands up. And he pitches forward and just lets loose the nastiest stream of vomit that I have seen. I mean, it's like partially digested peas and who knows what else. And I'm kind of looking around, and the other kids on the school bus are, they're laughing, you know, they're kind of holding their noses, they're teasing him. And I, on the other hand, am panicking. My heart rate goes up. My brain starts saying, you know, don't breathe. You'll get it inside of you if you breathe. What if it got on the sleeve of your sweatshirt? And I remember this sweatshirt. I wore it like every year for school pictures. It was my favorite. It was this pink sweatshirt with this sweet teal, like 80s style design on it. And you know, we get to the bus stop and I just run out. I run out and I go to, I was staying kind of at a babysitter's house because my parents worked. And the babysitter, you know, opens the door, and I'm just like all snot and tears and feeling terrible. And so she sits me down and she makes me Nesquik, you know, the little chocolatey drink. And I refuse to drink it, which is very out of character. And she just, you know, leans forward and she says, "What happened?" And mind you, I'm 7 or 8 years old, and I'm thinking back to the other kids on the bus, and I'm thinking back to their reactions, and nobody else was crying. Nobody else seemed to be panicking. So in that moment, I made the decision to tell her nothing. Nothing's wrong. And, you know, to be that young a kid and to be so ashamed of my symptoms and so embarrassed, that's essentially something that I continued to do, which is to not really talk about symptoms for over a decade. And, you know, knowing now that I had OCD symptoms, I had anxiety symptoms, I had what I now know to be compulsions, you know, that sweatshirt, I just buried it in the back of my closet and told my parents, I don't know where it went. And it was my, I was one of those like nerdy kids who was like, I'm wearing the same thing every day to school because it's my favorite. And I think why I do what I do now is because if you can have that tremendous amount of self-stigmatization at the age of 7 or 8, then we have a lot of work to do to kind of make OCD and anxiety, things that we can talk about and be open about and seek treatment about. So I would say that's really why my heart is in this. I've also, you know, I've had the benefit of great training and great mentors. But without the personal experience, I don't think any of this would have stuck.
Yeah. No, thank you for explaining that. And I'm sure you probably don't want to go into your story too much. Being a clinician, you obviously have to be somewhat reserved. So feel free to tell me to shut up. But what point did you kind of finally tell someone or get kind of help?
Well, it's interesting because what I would say is that everybody, that's a judgment there. But I think many people knew that I was kind of a quirky kid and that I was an anxious kid. You know, I talked to my mom about it recently and I was like, when did you know? Because the first time I remember really disclosing and talking about it, I was in college. And she said, well, I do remember there was one time in middle school where you thought that you were going to throw up. And your reaction was just so outsized that I wondered, like, what's that about? But, you know, other things like other sort of quirky behaviors, I think were just chalked up to being quirks. So I would say I started talking about it probably in college. And then by the time I got to grad school, I was I had gotten enough support, you know, that I felt like, A, I could talk about it more, but B, I was in such a better place as well. It was a little bit later.
Cool. Well, yeah, thank you for explaining that. Okay, so is there anything else you wanted to share on your story before we moved on?
No, I don't think so. I think I might have some clients who hear this and they're like, what?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for sharing. So your clinic, Nashville OCD and Anxiety Treatment Center, is the logo is a staircase. Why choose a staircase for the logo?
Yeah, so it's been such an incredible experience to open up a clinic, and I'm going to put incredible in giant air quotes because, you know, if I had known how hard it would be, I might not have endeavored to do it. But one of the parts that's been really interesting is this creative vision for what do we want to do? What do we want the clinic to represent? What are our values? And the staircase was chosen for a number of reasons, one of which is even though in treatment, I think a lot of clinicians, myself included, and our therapists included, are moving away from a strict hierarchical type model of, you know, here's our hierarchy and we're doing, you know, the lower things and then the higher things when we're doing ERP. So we're moving away from that. But I think it's so important that people know that the kind of treatment we do is sort of progresses in a stepwise fashion. So we're not going to, I think people hear about exposure and response prevention therapy and understandably, they're pretty mortified about the idea of just, you know, getting flooded. So that's part of the reason is that we say, you know, everything is, every step matters. So even if it feels like a really small step to you, we're going to start small and we're going to kind of build you up. And then when you get to the top of your, your treatment staircase or whatever it is, you sort of have this new vantage point with which to look at your life and to look at your decisions. So I like it both from the perspective of we're going to start small. We're going to kind of build you up. We're going to go at your pace. And then what a wonderful reward when you get to the top, it will be just like this beautiful vista. You know, you'll be able to see, hey, you know, here are my values. I'm living by my values and just get that clarity. So, you know, it's interesting because I heard about businesses doing these things and they're like, this is what our logo represents. And I'm always like, well, that's corny. Who really thinks about that? And then I did for like hours.
Yeah. Well, yeah, big brands spend millions on creating their logo. Yeah, so it's great to see you had some real thought behind it. And I saw that explanation on your website and I thought it was a great way to look at treatment. So thank you for explaining. So obviously got you on today, A, to chat with you, but B, specifically talk about transgender OCD or gender identity OCD, whatever term we want to use. Because as you were telling me before the show, you've got experience in kind of both fields, working with the trans community and also the OCD community with worries of being trans. So yeah, I guess before we start, just be good to define some terms around transgender issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really helpful, and to have that common vocabulary is helpful. If you're just working with the transgender population, you know, it's very affirming to kind of understand the language that's used, as well as if you're working with individuals who have gender identity themes to their OCD. You know, as you know, many people with OCD have done copious amounts of research around their themes. Mm. You know, obviously, like, that's compulsive a lot of the time, but they're also going to know these terms. And so I think it's kind of helpful from both perspectives. You'll hear me referring to cisgender, and cisgender, which is spelled C-I-S gender, is people for whom their gender identity matches the gender they were assigned at birth. And the reason I say gender assigned at birth, as opposed to, you know, like your sexual characteristics or chromosomes or anything like that, is there are a subset of individuals who are born with either some characteristics, sex characteristics of both sexes. You know, they're intersex individuals. There are people who have chromosomally are not XX or XY. You know, there are certain syndromes. Mm. So that's a really nice way to kind of clarify that. So cisgender, like I was born, was assigned female at birth, and I continue to identify as female, so I'm cisgender. Yeah. We sort of think of this as like the, I guess, kind of like the default, just because it's like the majority of people at this point. And so in contrast with that, transgender means any individual for whom their gender identity differs from the gender that they were assigned at birth. And this can manifest in a number of different ways. You can have folks who are male to female, so they're assigned male at birth and then choose to transition to female. You can have female to male. And then you can also have people who are gender fluid, which you can sort of see as I'm talking about it, probably why that might be a theme that OCD would want to latch on to, right? Like a lot of ambiguity. But these are individuals who see gender as a fluid construct, and maybe they're somewhere in the middle, maybe they're kind of figuring it out. And then there's non-binary individuals who identify as neither male nor female. Both the folks who do male to female, female to male, as well as non-binary and fluid, they're all going to fall under that transgender umbrella. So there's a lot of variability there as well.
Yeah. Cool. No, thank you for explaining that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but to me, the topic of trans, or the issue of trans, however we want to describe it, it seems like it's popped out of nowhere. But like when I was reflecting on this, I do remember the odd appearance of a trans character in, say, one of our sitcoms or soap operas here in the UK, like, you know, 15 years ago, I remember one. And you'd never heard anyone say they were trans or talk about trans, but here they were in a popular sitcom, I won't name it, in case I get it wrong. So it was present, but it's very present now. And I guess, A, is that true? And B, what impact has that had on people with OCD?
Yeah, great questions. I think about it this way. Transgender individuals have been around as long as people have been around. And the extent to which they've been allowed to be visible or had space to be visible is really what has changed. And there are even some cultures, like in certain Native American cultures, there is the idea of two-spirit individuals, who are individuals who are, again, sort of living outside of the binary, so male characteristics and female characteristics. And so I think that's something that you can go back and kind of see in literature, you can see in different cultures, but it's certainly something that is so much more visible now with individuals. You know, there are, like in the U.S., there have been a lot of recent legal battles for transgender individuals trying to get rights. I know here where I live in the state of Tennessee, there are no workplace protections for transgender individuals, which is like, yeah. It blows my mind. So although there's increased visibility, and I think increase advocacy and awareness, et cetera, I think there's still a lot to be done. And I would say, you know, I always think of OCD as being relatively opportunistic. Yeah. It's a little bit like a sponge, and it's going to, you know, suck up kind of whatever is there. When the symptoms come online, what is there? And if something like this is kind of in our cultural ether, where we're hearing a lot, we're seeing more trans actors and actresses and individuals in media, then I think that is, it's all fodder for OCD. And in particular, because of, like I said before, I think that there are a few reasons why this might be appealing to OCD. The first of which is it's this kind of inherently ambiguous space. You know, OCD likes for things to be black and white, or good and evil, or male and female, and transgender folks are challenging that and saying, hey, there's more than just this binary. Or maybe even if you believe in the binary, maybe you're not the gender that you thought. And so I think from that perspective, it can be really challenging for OCD. I think as well, you know, there's no like cheek swab or are you trans, are you cisgender? Mm-hmm. There's no blood test. And so it's really, again, there's no way of knowing. And so there's an inherent level of uncertainty. And so I'm realizing as I'm talking about this, you know, that, and I suppose every one of your podcasts is a little bit like this, but I'm feeling like, I'm sure there are people listening for whom this is a little bit difficult to hear, right? Or this is a little bit like hitting on, well, I never thought this was, you know, but it really is such a perfect breeding ground, I think, for OCD because of some of those factors and because of how prevalent it is now in the media.
So let's say I have transgender OCD. What are some of my compulsions and obsessions?
Yeah, so a lot of the, so oftentimes, you know, the obsessions are going to be this need to know for sure what your gender identity is and what impacts that may have. So there's always that kernel of, as there is, you know, one could argue with all OCD themes, there's always that kernel of this need for certainty, this need to know 100%. And then I think there are kind of offshoots of that in terms of the obsessions. You can have an offshoot about, you know, I worked with a young man who was really worried about authenticity, which you also see with sexual orientation OCD, you know, this idea of like, well, if I am, and he is, you know, cisgender, and if I am trans, then I've been living an inauthentic life. And what does that mean? You'll have other people who are worried about if I'm trans, then how's that going to impact my my relationships, will I be socially shunned, et cetera. Yeah. And then a lot of the kind of compulsions that you'll see will be things like mental reviewing of a past behavior. So a lot of times people will say things like, well, you know, when I was little, a parent said that one time, you know, they caught me dressing up in my sister's clothes, you know, if you're a guy or, so that kind of mental reviewing, oh, you know, I was a tomboy, or, oh, you know, I'm kind of more, you know, I'm into sports more than other girls, things like yeah. that. And so just like compulsively reviewing that, and, you know, the reassurance that goes along with that as well. I think too, comparisons to others. So like, am I feminine enough? So let's say I'm in a group of women and I myself have a thought, you know, hey, that you're, you know, you might be trans. I might start to, we'll see people kind of looking at their body posture vis-a-vis other people or their inflection, you know, things like that. So those are some of the compulsions. And then, you know, in terms of avoidance of anything that has to do with gender identity. So avoiding, you know, watching movies that will have trans themes, or I suppose, you know, part of the reason, again, like you said, we could call it trans OCD or gender identity OCD. And I sort of default to gender identity OCD because although I haven't yet seen a trans person with OCD who's worried about, well, what if I am cis, cisgender, I think it could go either way. Anyway, but yeah, so a lot of the kind of isolation and avoidance and things like that, or I can't be around folks who remind me that, you know, of androgyny or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you for explaining that. And I guess avoidance would be tough at the minute because there's a lot in popular culture, in the news. Yeah. Okay, so what are some of like the exposures you've done with some of your clients that have these concerns and worries?
Yeah, so things like, and it kind of depends a little bit on what the core fear is. So what does it mean if I'm trans? But one that I've used for individuals almost regardless of what the core fear is, and then I guess I can get into some differentiations. But one thing that I found is quite provocative is to make a list of individuals of the opposite gender of, you know, to the one that you identify as, that, you know, people you really admire, people you want to emulate, people you want to be like, because there what you're doing is you're activating this idea of, again, say if I'm a woman and I have this list of men I want to be like, that's really going to get the gender identity OCD going. So that's one thing. Sometimes there's like avoided clothing, so clothing that might look too androgynous. So sometimes it's about wearing clothing, and oftentimes, you know, for these people, it's like, well, this is I never thought twice about wearing this until my brain started telling me, like, I could be trans. Certainly engaging with media, like you said, you can't avoid it. So reading stories. Now, again, you want to be careful if somebody's reading like coming out stories about trans individuals and they're sort of looking for reassurance or comparing, like, does this sound like me? We want to avoid that, but that certainly could be an exposure. There are lots of movies that portray trans individuals or there are trans actors and actresses. So like Boys Don't Cry is a movie that has a trans female to male trans character. And then The Danish Girl is one male to female. And then there are certain actors and actresses, Laverne Cox, who's in Orange is the New Black, which we've done a lot of exposures with that. And then I think, too, if there are worries about kind of like social stigma, which, again, I mean, that's valid to some extent, right? But if somebody's really worried about, you know, how am I going to be perceived, then we had a teenager here who had these worries. And one of the things that she would do was we have like a little trans flag, like pride necklace, and she would walk around the office building with that as an exposure. Yeah. So those are just, a few.
Yeah, no, I like that. And again, I guess it's like any exposures. Is getting creative with it, right? Mm-hmm. We could be going to a pride march wearing I support trans rights or whatever it is t-shirt on. Obviously, as if that's a 9 or a 10, maybe don't start there, but that's interesting, thank you. And to, I guess, I don't want to say use the word reassure people, but I'm going to use it to reassure people, the effectiveness of exposures or ERP on transgender OCD or gender identity OCD is as effective as any other type of OCD. Absolutely. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's fair to say. It's, you know, it's like we all say when we all say until we're blue in the face. My clients like roll their eyes at this point where I'm like, you know, it's the content doesn't matter. It's the same thing in a different outfit. And they're like, I know this one is compelling in this moment. Yeah. So yeah, it's basically the same. It's the same sort of process. And in terms of things that can make it a little bit more difficult, I would say, it's, again, it's like anything else. If there is that willingness to trust in the process, even though the feared outcome might feel different this time or might feel scary, or there might even be some kind of like moral or religious things kind of caught up in there. Goodness. I mean, that's really hard work. And that is what, you know, what we would encourage clients to do to come out on the other side, and no pun intended with come out.
That's a good point on the pun. Have you seen any of your clients, let's say they, as far as you know, are cisgender and they are heterosexual, let's use that, and they obviously they've got trans OCD, but they've also got sexual orientation OCD, so they're worrying about being homosexual. Have you seen the two combined?
I haven't, actually. I haven't seen the two combined, but what I will say is that I have worked with individuals who have the gender identity OCD themes, who are both straight clients and gay, lesbian, bisexual clients. So it's, which I know is not this, that was not the question. I'm not equating the two, but I guess I'm saying that there is diversity. I don't necessarily, I haven't seen them together. And I don't know that they would have a propensity to hang together any more than any other two, you know, kinds of themes. But I will say that in this smallish sample that I've seen, it doesn't discriminate with respect to, like, you know, if you're already a member of a of the LGBTQ community, you're not sort of immune to having these types of themes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, no, thank you. That's interesting. So I was doing some research for this episode. I noticed in one of the charity forums on a thread talking about transgender OCD, one of the people in it said, I've paraphrased it here. Where is it? Oh, that was it. They're currently in therapy. This was a few years ago, but at the time they were currently in therapy. They were doing, but they weren't doing exposures for fear that if the exposures didn't work and kind of remove the OCD and anxiety, if they didn't work, it means it wasn't OCD and in fact they are trans. So they've not even started exposures for fear that it might prove. I guess, how would you work with that?
Well, that's a great question, and I feel for them because, you know, I think we've come to kind of, in our clinic here and the people that I supervise, we kind of call that the second layer. Mm. It's like sometimes OCD has layer upon layer upon layer, and sometimes the worry is, and that particular worry, what if it's not OCD and it's the real thing? Again, I think I see, you know, quote unquote, the real thing. I see that. And, you know, I see that a lot with harm OCD as well. You know, people who are like, well, I would do this, but then we're really going to, if it doesn't work, we're really going to get to the core of it. And I'm a murderer, which is kind of the point, too. We're like, OK, well, but we're going to, you know, we'll see either way. It's about kind of jumping into the uncertainty. So I would say to that individual, you know, that this is another way that your OCD is just trying to throw up a roadblock to prevent you from getting treatment. And so as hard as it is to trust in the process, particularly if this theme seems scarier than some other ones, it is about being willing to take that risk, to get there. And perhaps, you know, if this were a client of mine and they had other symptoms that they wanted to work on first, I would be completely amenable to that, because I think once you've seen, I don't know if they've ever had treatment before, but once you've kind of seen how exposure works, sometimes that can be, even though it feels like you're sort of shoehorning a difficult theme in, it doesn't quite fit. What if this is the time that it's not OCD? Sometimes if you've at least had some success, that can be a jumping off point, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So if they also had sort of contamination fears, you may start there. Is that fair to say? Yeah,
it is. And then, and again, not to, I realize in some senses, is that sort of fostering avoidance of that theme? Well, sure. But I think it's also empowering the individual to be able to say, like, I'm scared to work on this just yet. And again, so I said, you know, we don't necessarily have a strict hierarchy, but I think that part of the way that in this really difficult therapy that a therapist can show a client, you know, how much respect we have for them is to have those kinds of conversations and say, hey, look, my expectation for you is that I want you to completely, you know, address all of your symptom areas eventually. So we'll get there. But I do want you to feel like you're in the driver's seat as we're moving toward it. So I think that I feel like I'm a little bit off topic, but that's kind of one of my gripes with some practitioners of ERP, very few, but I think there's a way in which exposures can be sort of dealt out in a heavy-handed way where it's like, nope, this is your assignment right now, and it feels less collaborative. And I think that really, unfortunately, turns people off to the treatment.
Yeah, fair point. Okay, so let's say one of the listeners feels that they may have transgender OCD or gender identity OCD, but obviously they're not sure, hence the nature of OCD. What happens if it actually is? I guess what would you say to someone who, let's say, you know, it's the conference this week, they've come up to you, they've said this, what would you say to them in terms of like next steps?
Yeah, well, I would say if they're not in therapy, then, you know, go get there, get there as soon as possible. And I would say that I would want for them to cultivate a willingness to explore that topic further with their therapist. I would refrain from saying, well, let's find out if it is or if it isn't, because I mean, that's compulsive as well, right? Like, yeah. Part of this is, well, let's do the exposures. I'm not invested in, just like with sexual orientation OCD. And it's interesting. I do a lot of work with, you know, kids and teenagers too, and they can be so concrete. And like, I was working with a 13-year-old with sexual orientation OCD, and she was like, we're going to get to the bottom of this, right? We're going to get to the bottom of, like, if I'm gay or if I'm straight. I'm like, well, I got news for you, kid. We're actually maybe never going to get to the bottom of that. And maybe we will, and it won't be what you want it to be. And, like, that's the point. And she's just like, you know, then I got the stink eye from a teenager for, like, the next 20 minutes, and she barely talked to me. We eventually got there. She's doing great. But, yeah, I got a little bit off topic. But, yeah, I guess what I would say is, yeah, if you're thinking that might be something that's going on, get to therapy, you know, start talking about it, let go of this. There's going to have to be some letting go of the need for certainty around that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's the paradox of the whole thing and the whole treatment. And I think for a lot of people who go through, at least in my experience, who go through treatment for gender identity, OCD, and they go through exposures, at the end, they're kind of a little bit more like, well, I'm mostly sure. I'm like, sure enough. And, you know, and that could change tomorrow. Hmm. And that's the true, like, when somebody's able to say that, you're like, okay, I feel like you're in a good place with this.
Yeah. Yeah, really, really good point and good answer. That is the right attitude, like you said, you know. I don't know if I tomorrow might turn around and feel, actually, I feel like I identify as a woman, you know. I have no evidence that that won't be the truth tomorrow, not to trigger anyone. But I don't know. For me, it's also kind of, if that happens, I'd like to think, as painful as it would be, I would meet it with the same tolerance and compassion and try and work. You know, there's a quote by Marcus Aurelius, that Greek philosopher. He says something about you'll meet, don't worry about tomorrow's struggles or something, because you'll meet them with the same skill set and determination that you've met today's struggles, or something like that. And that always reassures me, not in an OCD way, but yeah.
yeah. I love that.
We our capacity to handle things is greater than we give ourselves credit for, I think, a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I talk a lot to my clients just generally about resilience.
Yeah.
And about this, like, there is this thing that happens in therapy where if it's been a hard week, or it's been a hard, you know, there's, it feels something that just feels like backsliding. I hear that a lot. There's a lot of like you know, I'm afraid I'm backsliding. And encouraging people to, I wish I could, and I suppose I could with their consent, but to have like some kind of a way to have them on session one say, like, these are the things that I feel like I'll never be able to do, and I am convinced of it. And then to be able to look back at that, and throughout the weeks be like, nope, you've done that, you've done that, you've done that. So yeah, I think OCD is one of its most insidious characteristics, is not just like the obsessions and the compulsions, but the way it can kind of cut you out at the knees with like, you can't handle that, you can't do that. So I've been so into the integrating and self-compassion into work because of that. I think that's the, you know, with what I said earlier about shame and embarrassment, it's kind of like it's attacking you on so many different fronts. So yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you for explaining that. I think self-compassion is huge for everyone, but especially people with OCD. Okay, so before we move on, is there anything else you want to share or say on this form of OCD?
No, I don't think so. I think, I do think again that, you know, if I guess, you know, for people who, I have something to say. Get used to that too. I always have something to say. So yeah. That's the, No, I mean, I guess when I think about it, having worked again with like the transgender population, a little, you know, a little bit clinically, I just work mostly with OCD. So it's just people who are, have OCD and are also transgender. But I've done also some advocacy work in the transgender community. And I will say, you know, there is that, there's such a difference between people with transgender individuals. The discrepancy is between their gender and either the body that they're in or the way that they're perceived. That's where the rub is. That's where the discomfort is. And so when you see it with trans OCD, you know, it's just, it's not about that. It feels really different. So yeah. I would say as well that, you know, because I think one question that I've gotten is like, well, but how do you know? And well, first of all, let go of the need to know. But second of all, there tends to be that, you know, there's a real difference there in terms of somebody wanting to express who they are versus somebody being worried about the possibility of who they are.
Yeah, yeah, really, yeah, brilliant point. Yeah, and it's kind of with the OCD or the trans-themed OCD, it's obviously, it's all kind of what ifs, you know, as yeah. opposed to, as you said, that actual feeling that the trans population have. It's not probably, does the what ifs not appear as much for the trans population? Is that fair to say in how they experience it? Or is there still some kind yeah. of?
It just, there's a different feeling. And again, it feels a little, you know, I feel like again, as a cisgender woman being like, this is what it's like. Obviously there's that caveat of, you know, I think there are a myriad of different experiences out there. And so I know I can't know what it's like for everyone, but I think there's that, the worries are more about kind of how will I be perceived, what will happen to my relationships. But there's this sense of like, wow, I'm not authentically living to be who, you know, living in accordance with my gender, which does feel really different than the kind of what ifs.
Yeah.
So there might be some what ifs, like what if people reject me, et cetera, but they tend not to be about the gender itself. Yeah. Or at least there's less of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes sense. And yeah, it's my curiosity. I'm trying to learn, hopefully. Okay, cool. No, thank you for that. And hopefully that's been really helpful for some people. So you've recently been doing some awareness building using illustrations on your clinic's Instagram page. And I'll put a link to the Instagram handle in the show notes and stuff so people can check it out. But yeah, tell us kind of about that, why do it, what it's been like, the feedback, etc.
Yeah, it's been really fun. I've always loved, I've always just been a creative person. And so when I was in, when I was in high school, I drew comics and I was involved in something called the zine community, which is like self-published magazines, just been really interested in that. And on the other hand, so I guess to back up, I had, I lead treatment groups and I had an adult OCD treatment group. We were like, it was toward the end of the group and I was asking the group, and they were mostly in their 20s, early 30s, and I was asking the group a little bit about like, how do you consume information, or like, how do you find out about things? And they were talking about Instagram, and I very sort of judgmentally was like, oh, well, like clinics don't get on Instagram, right? Like mental health, like what, that's not a thing. And they were like, have you, like, how old are you? Which I was like, I'm not that much older than you, but apparently I had no idea. So. So they were like, yeah, you know, the clinic should have an Instagram account. So I went and I did what I always do. I did my research and I went out there and I looked at other existing accounts and therapists, et cetera. And I just thought, there's so much great content out there already. What can I do to put a spin on it and bring something that's a little bit different? And so I decided to kind of wed my love of doodling. We had just gotten, my husband and I had gotten a new toy, basically iPad Pro with a
pencil,
stylus. And I was...
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. And so I was like, well, I'm already doodling all the time. What about if I kind of put these two together? So I made a few comics and it's been a really cool response. I think it's a fun way to engage people. I think there's an irreverence and a playfulness that you can bring to the comics that, you know, is a little bit different than just kind of like the inspirational quotes. I don't think it's quite to the level of irreverence as like memes. I feel like I'm deep into the internet world now. I'm like, well, there's memes and there's the quotes and there's this and that. But yeah, it's been a great response, and it's been really fun to try to distill some really, I guess, complex therapy concepts into just these little four panel or one panel comics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like them. I was looking through them. Was it the other day? Yeah. I think they're great. And like you said, I think mental health is a heavy topic, can be a heavy topic. It's definitely heavy as an experience for those going through it. So doing it as a comic or an illustration is a good way of adding a bit of lightness, and I don't want to say fun, but maybe that is the word. And a good way to do education. All right. Yeah, cool. No, I encourage people to go check that out. There's lots on there. So just general words of hope for people with OCD, regardless of whatever theme they're concerned with.
Yeah. You already, if you're out there and you have OCD, think about how incredible it is that you have a portion of your brain that is allotted to either OCD worries or to management of OCD, and think about everything that you are doing despite that. Think about the fact that essentially you have these cognitive resources that have been reallocated from the things that you care about into these other things, and yet you're still getting up every day. You're still, you know, you're going to work or you're going to school or you're not, and you're just getting out of bed, and that's still pretty incredible, because there are many out there who, you know, they have full use of their brains. And just think about too, I do believe in the treatment. I believe that people can feel a whole lot better. So if you're there and you're like spinning your wheels and feeling like I've got, you know, a significant portion of my brain devoted to OCD, just think about A, how amazing it is that you're doing what you're doing. And then B, when you free that up, think about the possibilities and really, you know, allow yourself to dream about those possibilities, because it's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great words. Okay, so you've got a time-traveling phone, if that's the right way of saying it. You pick up, call your 20-year-old Amy. What would you tell her?
Oh, man. I would say stop changing your major. I changed my major in college, like, on the regular. I pretty much studied everything. And provided that I had landed on psychology at that point, I would say stop, chill out. Because psychology will afford you the opportunity to be able to, have a job that allows you to be both science-based and kind of data-driven, but also really creative. So yeah, I would say that. I'd also say, stop trying to make bangs a thing that works on your face, because it's just not the hairstyle for everyone. And those would be my words of wisdom.
Nice. No, I like it. It's interesting because in this country, you can do a master's you don't have to do a master's to become a therapist. You can do like a diploma or whatever. But if you do a master's, it's either a master's of science or a master's of art. And I don't know if that's the same in the States.
Yeah.
So then that raises the question, is therapy a science or is it an art? And let me ask you that. Well, how would you?
I love that question. I think therapy is both. Good therapy is both. I think science is the foundation. That's another big thing in our clinic here in Nashville. It's like we only do evidence-based treatments, where we apply them flexibly, and we're going to meet people where they are. And we're going to, you know, if one thing isn't really working, we might use some other techniques to enhance, say, a straight ERP program. But it's got to have that science base. And I think from that structure, in order to connect with people, symptoms are just as varied as people. And we know people are incredibly varied and creative and intelligent, and they have all different ways that their symptoms manifest. So I think that creativity is the piece that kind of bridges the gap between here's my protocol and here's, you know, an effective application of the protocol. Exposure therapy in particular, I think, is just I think that it can't be done without a measure of creativity. And I think, you know, sure, you can have a kind of list of here, all the, you know, all the contamination exposures that I've ever done with someone and all the harm exposures. And then somebody's going to walk in the door and their fear is going to be so idiosyncratic. And it's going to be something you've never really heard before. And on the spot, you know, that's the fun of it for me. Is trying to figure that out and sort of join them in that. So I believe I have, actually, it's right there on the wall. I have a Master of Arts.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know, Doctor of Philosophy makes it sound even less scientific, right? It's like
totally
theoretical, but anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, it's obviously Doctor of Psychology. It's just like the, ultimately, I don't think there's a difference, to be honest. There's as much science in both of them. But thank you for indulging my curiosity. So last question then. You've got a billboard in Nashville. What do you want written on that billboard?
I'm so glad you asked this because I've been prepping my answer. Like, I'm just going to be real with you. I've been prepping it since, like, well before I was on this podcast. Like, I've heard the podcast and I've been like, oh, man, okay. So here's the deal. I've got this billboard and what's it going to be? And there have been so many good answers. Mm. So here's what I'm thinking. I want it to be, some of the billboards are informational and some are inspirational, and I want mine to be experiential. So here's what I'd like. And I'm going to ask for two billboards because
of
who I am as a person. Okay, so I've got two billboards, and the first one is going to have, in big block letters, it's going to say, don't read this billboard. And the second one is going to say, unwanted, violent, and sexual thoughts are just as automatic, for more information, and then a website about intrusive thoughts. Because when I was thinking about it, I was like, oh man, it's a billboard. It's going to reach a lot of people. Who do I want to reach, and what do I want them to know? And I would say the number one thing for me is I do most of the screenings for our clinic here. So when people call and they're in that very vulnerable state and I'm asking them about, you know, tell me about your symptoms. And I hear that moment of hesitation or I hear them say, I'm not really comfortable saying it or it's so weird. It brings me back again to that experience of like being a kid and being like, yeah, this is just too weird. I can't talk about it. This is just too weird. So in those moments, you know, one of the phrases that I use a lot is this idea of quote unquote OCD normal. Like when people tell you, you know, I thought about, you know, engaging in a sexual act with like a religious figure. It's like, oh, that's OCD normal. Or, you know, I thought about whatever outlandish thing it is. Or I think a billboard that would get to those folks and in a really experiential way too. Like that's a little bit of a wake up, like, whoa, hey, that's out of my control.
No, I like it. Very creative. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. So is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared today?
No, this has been great. Thank you.
Cool, no worries. Well, thank you for giving your time and covering this theme of OCD. Hopefully it's useful for people, which I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, I hope so.
So there you have it. Really hope you enjoyed my conversation with Amy, and everything will be at theocdstories.com where you can find out more. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.